In an ideal world, people of all races and creeds would live peacefully side by side. But as we have seen, particularly with the conflict in the Middle East and other trouble spots around the world, that is a very rare concept. Discrimination, arrogance, power and greed always seem to take precedence, together with opportunism and a sense of entitlement. In theory, many races appear to live happily side by side, but in reality, there is often stark discrimination. Josh Bornstein, lawyer and advisory board member of the Jewish Council of Australia, is quoted as saying, "Social cohesion is impossible in a liberal democracy unless we embrace the right to disagree with one another." In the early days of EDBC, we used to have combined services at Easter and Christmas with the other churches. If I remember correctly, they were the Anglican, Uniting, Presbyterian, Church of Christ, Catholic and Baptist. At Easter, the children would have activities at St. David's Church just across the road here, and then after the service, they would come down for morning tea with the rest of the people. At Christmas, we would all contribute gifts to the Christmas tree to be distributed to needy families. Each church hosted a service. The churches were always full of families and packed to the doors. On several occasions, we had a Catholic priest preaching at the Uniting Church and the Baptist minister preaching at the Catholic Church and so on. And it was inspiring to see a row of nuns sitting in the Uniting Church. These services continued until the Anglicans decided that they wished to cease doing that and worship separately in future. Joint services continued with the other churches, but they were never quite the same. In those days, there was a minister's fraternal. I don't know if they exist these days, but certainly the name would need to change. The local ministers worked in harmony to promote the Christian message in the local community. The Catholic priest was not officially allowed to participate in this, but it was suggested to him that if he happened to be passing a certain house at a certain time on a Tuesday morning, he'd be most welcome to drop in for a cup of coffee, and he did that on several occasions. In the late 1960s, five members of this particular group of ministers, in consultation with the local mayor and councillors, sought to identify the needs of the rapidly growing suburb. They decided to put $5 each into a bank account and take it from there, little knowing where it would lead. What eventuated was the Doncaster Care and Counselling Centre, known now as Doncare, which was initially given free space in the newly built Doncaster shopping town, now Westfield. It was staffed by many volunteers and is still going strong today, serving and supporting the people of Manningham. Some of our members have been involved in its activities over the years, and I think Dorothy's still going, which is lovely. In the past, the Doncaster Mosque in George Street opened its doors to other churches, having an annual open day where everyone was welcome. I doubt whether that could happen in today's climate. I still have the order of service for a civic service held in July 2005 at St. Peter and Paul's Catholic Church, supported by the Manningham Interfaith Network, at which our minister at the time, Chris Page, preached. At one stage during the service, all the faith leaders gathered at the altar where blessings were given by representatives of the following faiths: Baha'i, Buddhist, Christian, Hindu, Jewish, Muslim and Sikh. It was a very moving time in that service. The following common statement from the Interfaith Network was read: "We bring greetings from the faith communities to the mayor, councillors and the people of the City of Manningham. We offer the City of Manningham our common commitment to seek to live together in peace and goodwill. We affirm our desire to promote respect and tolerance for the integrity of one another's beliefs, cultures and traditions. The desire arises not only from our common humanity, but also from our being people of faith and people of prayer. We recognise that as neighbours we have responsibilities to the community, the world and ourselves. We therefore urge all citizens, both religious and non-religious, to put aside intolerance, prejudice and divisiveness to attain peaceful and fruitful coexistence in our city. A very significant statement, which we could do well to distribute in this common climate of discord. And a former youth pastor of our church, the Reverend Andrew Woff, left us to become the pastor of the Newport Baptist Church. During his tenure there, the Muslim community applied to the council for a permit to build a mosque. Well, you can imagine the outcry from the local community. But rather than oppose that application, the Baptists supported it and helped the Muslims to achieve their goal. We've always had a supportive church community, but I think we've established greater closeness by sitting around tables for morning tea. Our conversations are more relaxed as we sit and find out more about each other. And recent activities by protest groups in public places has perhaps made some of us a bit edgy. So it's more important than ever to accept our differences in a loving environment, as well as embracing those things on which we agree and share. It's interesting to read in the scriptures about how Jesus treated those from other cultures, activities which were censured at times even by his followers. He was questioned or taken to task but for sharing meals with sinners, speaking with or touching with the untouchables and the outcasts, talking to the woman at the well from a different culture and a woman. What was he thinking? He told the very familiar story of the Good Samaritan, which Cassandra read to us, the person who helped the man who'd been attacked, while those other passers-by who might have been expected to help ignored his cries for help and passed by on the other side. Perhaps we could imagine this story in today's world by changing the culture to a Russian man having been attacked by thieves and a Ukrainian man going to his aid and going the extra mile by finding the injured man accommodation and offering to pay for all his expenses. I think back over some of the neighbours John and I have had over the past 61 years. When we first moved to Doncaster, soon after the first birth of our first child, on one side of our neighbours were Lebanese Muslims, a lovely couple with a young child. They were very hospitable and we built a good relationship with them and their friends. But unfortunately, some of the other neighbours hurled abuse at them when passing, making life fairly uncomfortable for them. 4 years later, we built a new home in East Doncaster with a couple of changes of neighbours next door. The couple with whom we developed a very close friendship were Don and Helen and their two-year-old daughter, Michelle, who's now in her mid-40s. Helen had been born in Eastern Europe but had grown up in Egypt. And Don was a down-to-earth, dinky-dye Aussie with a heart of gold. As we established our garden, we'd be out in the backyard working and a face would appear over the fence. Oh, you're doing some work in the garden. He'd hop over the fence and pick up a pick or shovel. Wonderful neighbour. He and Helen were also very hospitable and we spent many happy hours discussing all manner of things with them, their family and friends. Don was always very dogmatic, having an answer for everything. But John and I held our own most of the time. He was fairly critical of the church, but when his health began to deteriorate, he suddenly started asking questions about our beliefs. That led to some very significant conversations, and he and Helen then started attending St David's Anglican Church. After Don's death, we stayed in touch with Helen and her daughter Michelle after they moved to Warrandyte. And I was privileged to conduct Helen's funeral a couple of years ago and still stay in touch with Michelle, who lives interstate. They were very important connections in today's unpredictable world. Good neighbours are so important. Although Jesus wasn't always predictable, he was always compassionate, seeing the good in the very people who'd been rejected by their fellow travellers. His focus was on the needs of the other person, not worrying about what education they'd had, who they were, or how his actions might be perceived. It's easier to relate to people when you know they believe the same as you, but it's more of a challenge when their beliefs are different from yours. Some time ago, I watched a TV program about a group of English celebrities of various faiths as well as non-believers who embarked on a spiritual pilgrimage from Switzerland to Rome, a 1,000-mile journey taken over 15 days, some of it on foot and some in a minibus. Their diverse beliefs included a Muslim, a Jew, a lapsed Jehovah's Witness, and an atheist. The group comprised of two actors, a professional dancer, two comedians, an Olympic long jump champion, a TV presenter, and a Eurovision winner with an age range from 28 to 72. And they met each other for the first time on the first day. So a very interesting group of people. They stayed in basic hotels, shared dorms, and followed a largely untrodden route. They saw spectacular scenery, visited interesting cultural landmarks, chatted with friendly locals. But as time went on, it was really interesting to observe how they began to really listen to each other's stories and even be prepared to participate in rituals of other faiths at the various towns that they visited. When they finally reached their destination, St. Peter's Square in Rome, they were thrilled to be granted an audience with the late Pope Francis. There was a certain amount of trepidation, especially with the atheist comedian, who wondered how on earth he would be received. He was also gay and a man of colour, who'd experienced a great amount of discrimination in his life. But the Pope welcomed them warmly, spending half an hour chatting with them, and then asked if anyone had any questions they'd like to ask. In my mind, the details are a bit hazy, but my memory is that the atheist plucked up the courage to ask if he would be acceptable to God, if he existed, as a gay man of colour. The Pope reached out to him, taking him by both hands, and assured him that God's love is for everyone who desires it. And that, with that response, there was hardly a dry eye in the room. And as the group departed, the Pope blessed them all, an extraordinary, emotional and powerful ending to their journey. In today's world, we see so much hatred, discrimination and judgment. So how do we live life while trying to process all the conflict, which could eventually affect all of us? How do we keep our focus on the goodness in life? It's more important than ever to keep our focus on Jesus Christ and leave the conflict to those who have some power to address it. It's also important to keep our personal relationship on an even keel, making ourselves available to listen when people need a listening ear. We look at what is happening in the Middle East and wonder if there is any possibility of a change in that conflict. But in The Age yesterday, I was heartened to read an article by Matthew Knott entitled "Moderates Meet in Middle in Bid for Lasting Peace." I don't know whether any of you read that, but it read in part, 4 months after the Brutus Hamas attacks on the 7th of October 2023, Palestinian activist Samir Sinul Jalawi visited Kfar Aza, the scene of one of the day's worst massacres. Standing in front of the news cameras, he used his visit to condemn the slaughter shown to Israelis and people around the world that not all Palestinians endorsed Hamas's violent attacks. This man had spent 5 years in an Israeli prison from the age of 15 for throwing stones at Israelis during the First Intifada. Now he's a leading proponent for peace and a two-state solution. He condemns calls for erasing a people that helps no one, least of all Palestinians. This week he will travel to Australia for appearances with his friend Gershon Baskin, an Israeli activist and veteran hostage negotiator who served as a key communicator with Hamas. After first meeting at a conference in 1996, they met again 3 years later through their work to advance a two-state solution, which would see an independent Palestinian state established alongside Israel. Despite coming from different sides of the conflict, they discovered that they had similar perspectives on the way forward. They wanted to show that civil dialogue and even agreement between Israelis and Palestinians remains possible. It's good to see these two men working together to find a common path to peace. We need to focus on that kind of dialogue rather than the way many people in the world are interacting with each other in a negative way, which can cause such great anxiety. Julia Baird wrote an article some time ago addressing this issue. She said how we might react is to maintain our sanity and good mental health. She quoted Ryan Holiday, a best-selling author, who sent out a newsletter entitled, "Here's How I'm Preparing for the Next 4 Years," in response to the American presidency. He reminded readers history is full of times of turbulence, and that the philosopher Epictetus said our chief task in life was to focus on what we can control. Holiday wrote that he was going to read old books, remind himself what his job is, raise his kids well, keep a journal, use his platform on what he thinks is important, treat people well, prioritise stillness, contribute to his community, not always feel the need to have an opinion, and try to be philosophical, not cynical. He continued, "I'm focused on what will still matter in 5, 10 or 15 years, or 50 years, character, discipline, patience, the value of hard work. These are constants, no matter who's in office, no matter what's happening in the headlines. It may be hard not to let all these negative world events affect us, but he encourages us not to let cruelty harden us, not to let stupidity make us bitter, not to let outrage pull us down to its level." He quoted Marcus Aurelius, who wrote, "The best revenge is not to be like that. The point really is to do what you need to do to stay strong, because in times of profound chaos, strength is required, and help others however, wherever, whenever you can." So from where do we gain that strength? We believe that our strength comes from God through his Son, Jesus Christ, who remains by our side whatever is happening in the world around us. In Paul's letter to the Ephesians, we read, "Be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Put on the full armour of God so that you can take your stand against the devil's schemes. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of the dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms." And then in one of his letters to Timothy, "But the Lord stood at my side and gave me strength, so that through me the message might be fully proclaimed and all the Gentiles might hear it." And then to the church at Philippi, "I have learned to be content, whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need. I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. I can do all this through him who gives me strength." This is where we gain our inner strength. And then to reach out to others, we need to focus on the goodness of people, focus on the love and power of God, focus on what we can do to make the world a better place. And how do we do that? By continuing to support and encourage one another, by showing love where it would be easy to show resentment or even hate, by really healing rifts in relationships, by reaching out to those who feel rejected, by showing tolerance to those with whom we might disagree, by having a united front against the negative influences in the world. In short, by showing the love of God in every way we can. I close with this story, probably familiar to you, but very relevant in this troubled world. It's told by the Russian poet Yevgeny Yevtushenko in his autobiography. In 1941, Mama took me back to Moscow. There I saw our enemies for the first time. If my memory is right, nearly 20,000 German war prisoners were to be marched in a single column through the streets of Moscow. The pavement swarmed with onlookers, cordoned off by police and soldiers. The crowd, mostly women, Russian women with hands roughened by hard work, lips untouched by lipstick, and thin, hunched shoulders, which had borne half the burden of the war. Every one of them must have had a father or husband, a brother or son killed by the Germans. They gazed with hatred in the direction from which the column was to appear. At last we saw it. The generals marched at the head, massive chins stuck out, lips folded disdainfully. Their whole demeanour meant to show superiority over their plebeian victors. "They smell of eau de cologne, the bastards," someone in the crowd said with hatred. The women clenched their fists. The soldiers and police had all they could do to hold them back. But all at once something happened. They saw German soldiers, thin, unshaven, wearing dirty, blood-stained bandages, hobbling on crutches or leaning on the shoulders of their comrades, the soldiers walking with their heads down. The street became dead silent. The only sound was the shuffling of boots and the thumping of crutches. Then I saw an elderly woman in broken down boots push herself forward and touch a policeman's shoulder, saying, "Let me through." There must have been something about her that made him step aside. She went up to the column, took from inside her coat something wrapped in a coloured handkerchief. It was a crust of black bread. She pushed it awkwardly into the pocket of a soldier, so exhausted that he was tottering on his feet. And now suddenly from every side, women were running towards the soldiers, pushing into their hands bread, cigarettes, whatever they had. The soldiers were no longer enemies. They were people. Amen.